And you remember I've quoted this terrible line about John Osborne. I think it's terrible. It's a compliment, but it's a horrible thing. And that is, he's an idealist who's never been able to find an ideal. He's not a cabbage. He's not a bourgeois mentality. He really wants to be an idealist, but he's never found an ideal to have to be a follower of. And so we find him back here in The Angry Young Men, banging away at the establishment. And that's all very well, because up to a point, because we must say that the establishment is really decadent in many, many ways. And then I would bring you back to the problems again. Let me repeat them. What happens when the church goes beyond the Bible in detail? What happens when it passes into law? Those things that not they may be morally right, but the way they're couched, they bring cruelty with them. And then what happens when the culture is gone? There's no doubt about it that the establishment in our countries, in England in a very real way, but not only England, in a way it's yesterday. And it's all very well. There would be certainly the Christians ought to be the first one to bang away at the establishment. We ought to be the rebels at this point. But what happens if you don't have anything to put in the establishment's place? That's the problem. Isn't it nice to be among the in people? Isn't it nice to have sexual orgies that can be described as innocent and lead to salvation, quote unquote? Isn't that lovely? Isn't it nice to be able to suddenly latch on to an affluent young people who have so much money and to a breakdown of the class system in England and then latch on to the affluent rising tide of working young people? Isn't it lovely? Well, in its own setting, something worthwhile could come out of it. But what happens, on the other hand, if you only are destructive? And as you're only destructive, you have nothing to put in its place. That's the trouble with our culture. The trouble with our culture is not just that it sees the rottenness of some of the things that remain, but when it destroys them, it has nothing to put in its place. Nothing to put in its place whatsoever. Now, this is our relativism. It's what has caused it. It is men turning away from that which produced the culture. And that is not just the word God, but really knowing God was there. It's not just Toynbee's idea of believing it, in a sense. Some getting people to believe it psychologically, especially the people you're trying to manipulate. But our culture was built upon, in the Northern Europe, upon men who really, truly believed it. They really believed it was true. They really knew it was true. And they really knew God had loved men, even to the death of Christ. And so they had a base to build on. And now, here it's destroyed. And we are surrounded by relativism on every side. And there's a smashing of these things, and so far, up to this point, nothing to put in its place. Not really. And then on the other hand, what you have are some of these older men who have a memory of what they like. And intuitively, they act upon this memory without any base whatsoever. This is a pathetic group of men. Believing what would produce A, and yet at the same time, liking in memory B. Now then, this leads our culture, therefore, to a tremendous problem. What comes next? And I would suggest that our 20th century, the second half of the 20th century, are trying three different solutions in the midst of this situation. Three different solutions, none of them returning back to the historic base of Christianity, incidentally. But three biblical Christianity. But three solutions. And if all goes well, the next Farrell House lecture I'll give, we will look into these three attempts of the world in the second half of the 20th century to the problem of what happens when this is smashed and you have nothing to put in its place. Well, now tonight we come to the second lecture of the short series entitled Relativism in the 20th Century and the World's Three Solutions. Relativism in the 20th Century and the World's Three Solutions. And last time we considered relativism in the 20th Century. And now tonight we'll go on to the World's Three Solutions. And the first solution is that of Romanticism. And Romanticism is far from dead. It takes on many, many forms.
really is often found in very unusual places. I would give a few forms of this romanticism, though this isn't by any means an exhaustive study of romanticism in our generation. The first would be Jacques Barzon, and I think he stands out, in my mind, as probably the most brilliant of romanticists I know in our generation. Jacques Barzon is a professor at the University of Columbia. He's best known for this book, The House of Intellect. This is the front cover. I've just removed it for carry it with me at times when I didn't want to lug the whole book. The House of Intellect, with appropriate pages torn out, of course, Jacques Barzon. This was, it's a Mercury book, printed in London, but the first printing was in 1959, so it's not too long ago. It's very much up to date. And I think Jacques Barzon comes up with poor answers because he makes a poor analysis of the problem. I think he misses the point. He sees the breakdown in philosophy as an accident. I don't think it's this at all. I think he misses the real trend in philosophy that we would deal with here up to Hegel and then through Kierkegaard and what we would call the line of despair. And because of this, because he makes a poor analysis, putting the enemies rather as art and science as such, and the mass mind, he places these things as the enemy rather than seeing something back of these. And this being the case, he still tries to hang desperately onto his romanticism. He has continued to do this. For example, in the Saturday Evening Review of October 1928, later, in 1961, there is a review here of a book he has put out, Classic, Romantic, and Modern by Jacques Barzon, put out by Little Brown, $5, in which he deplores the contemporary artist's rejection of Romanticism and urges its revival. And then later still, a review of another book, Science, the Glorious Entertainment, by Jacques Barzon, and this is in 1964. So he continues to do the same thing, in which he continues to put forth a cry, we have come into bad situations, wouldn't it be nice just to return to a romantic solution? And as I say, I think his basic dilemma is a poor analysis of the problem, and as such, really doesn't give a solution. He just always is saying, in a way, let's go back to romanticism. Now, I have used these two men together, this one and the one I'm going to use next in a previous lecture, in which I dealt with this more in detail. I feel the same thing can be felt very strongly with this man Hartford, who is the money and the idea behind the Gallery of Modern Art, which was opened in New York City in the March of 1964. And he shows his romanticism and his desire to go back constantly by looking back to the pre-Raphaelite paintings. And he's really saying here, and he fought for this for a long time, though now in his museum his curator has carried it further, but he has fought for the idea, let's just go back to what we find in the pre-Raphaelite paintings. And I think this is for the same reason, that here again we do not find a man who has analyzed what I would call the motion of history. It seems to me that the pre-Raphaelite paintings were reasonable at a particular point in the development from a Reformation culture into the modern culture. And at a certain point, these had a natural and proper place, a normal place. But to try to just say without any thing added to the modern situation, wouldn't it be nice to have this kind of a situation? Let's go back to it, is again, I think, an exhibition of a romantic and attempted romantic answer. A very different way than these two men, and yet I think related to them, is a man who is very important among a certain group of people in the United States. He's an economist by the name of Leonard E. Reed. He heads the Foundation for Economic Education Incorporated in Irvington on the Hudson, New York. I was given a man who was very close to him, heard me lecture when I was in the States and was very kind, and gave me one of his books called The Free Market and Its Enemy. This was published in 1965, so it's very much up to date. And this group centers particularly in understanding our dilemma as being the dilemma of communism. Or perhaps more properly, not just communism as communism, but rather just a collective concept in being the chief enemy. And as such, he puts forth with great fervor in this book, The Free Market and Its Enemy, he puts forth with great fervor the cry to return to a status, to a hands-off economy. And this is his solution. And he argues very interestingly in this book, which it seems to me places him among the romantics. And that is, he says, if you look at the complexity of the molecular situation, if you consider the molecular situation in the universe and you examine the molecular situation, it looks like chaos. And yet, if you just keep your hands off of it, eventually it produces something, it produces order. Now, he says, this is the same with men, that you seem to have a chaotic situation, but if you just keep your hands off of it with no controls whatsoever, it would produce something beautiful. But, of course, there's a little mistake here, because men are not machines. And you have a fallen man. And this is, of course, a different situation. And this is the place where romanticism comes on a rock. That actually, no matter what the form of romanticism is, I'll mention Lippmann next, no matter what the form of romanticism is, no, Lippmann isn't next, I'm sorry, but soon, no matter what the form of romanticism is, it comes on the rock of the fact that there are two elements in man, something wonderful, something productive, and we must never stop saying man is wonderful, man is not junk, and yet at the same time an element that is destructive and cruel. And so you have a different thing here. You can take the molecular situation of the entire universe, and indeed looks chaotic, to a man who doesn't know what he's looking at, yet eventually it brings forth order. But that is a machine area. It's a very, very different thing, than coming into the lost world of men. And when you take men, of course, and this is the reason men of all ages have found the necessity of some form of government, and that is when you take men and you turn him loose, you have a very different situation. You don't have a situation where it automatically brings forth beauty. There is something in the human race, and we as Christians think we know what, but there is something in the human race that, if you grant absolute freedom, does not come up with the same kind of a situation as you do if you allow the molecular freedom and the atomic freedom of the universe to function. So this is a different form of romanticism. A romanticism dealing largely in the area of economics. But nevertheless, romanticism. Another form of romanticism is something, again, that I dealt with in one of the lectures, but would bring in here because it is a proper place. And this is John W. Gardner's book called The Society and the Status Quo. The Society and the Status Quo, : The Individual in the Innovative Society. And this is written by John Gardner, who is president of the Carnegie Foundation. This book was actually written in 1961, and the review I have before me is a book review by Clark Kerr. Now, the interesting thing, of course, about this particular thing is that Clark Kerr is so closely connected to the University of California and the whole Berkeley situation, which has developed more recently. This review is dated 1964, though the book was written in 1961. Now, the interesting thing about this is that you find an interplay of Gardner coming up with a suggestion, and yet not having a base for the suggestion. So it turns out to be relative, though actually I think it is the right suggestion in the area of government. It's the right suggestion, but with no base. And so Clark Kerr, with an entirely different mentality, just machine guns it. Now, what Gardner, president of the Carnegie Foundation, has written here is the plea for checks and balances in government. Now, the interesting thing about this, of course, as we shall see in a moment, is this is exactly what the Reformation's solution to government was, and that was checks and balances there in the Reformation society, the culture and society, which came from the Reformation, a concept of checks and balances. Well, now, Gardner is bringing this in, but bringing it in without any base, without the base that produced it. In other words, in its own way, it would seem to me that he's saying exactly the same thing as Hartford is saying in going back to the Raphaelite paintings. Let's just go back, because it was nicer back there. I remember sort of the days when it was just simpler than it is now. Let's go back to it. But not distinguishing the fact that the checks and balances were produced from a certain philosophic consensus, or religious consensus, namely, in general, the consensus of the post-Reformation man. Now then, he's saying, let's go back to it, but there's no base to go back to it. And so, consequently, you don't have the same situation. So I would suggest that here is an interesting thing. Here is, it seems to me, a proper solution, and yet without a base, it is a romanticism. It's a romanticism because there's no base to have what really is a very fine solution of checks and balances. And in this sense, it seems to me it's just as romantic as Barzan. And incidentally, I admire Barzan very much. He's a very clever man, and a man who understands a lot of things. But romantic situation, Hartford's pre-Raphaelite painting, or such a man as this very sharp economist, Reed. And yet in each case, saying, let's do this, when actually there is, without dealing with the real problems, and therefore not having a base to substantiate even a right solution, which it seems to me Gardner is putting forward. Now Kerr, interestingly enough, and remembering all that happened to Berkeley, this becomes particularly intriguing to me. Kerr, in reviewing this book, tells what's in the book, speaks of the fact of the needs of checks and balances, as Gardner puts it out, and then he begins to give his appraisal. And as he gives his appraisal, his second point is like this. He says here, he introduces this, I should like to add some observations of my own, one, and then two. And this is his second observation of his own. It's a very funny way to review a book, actually, because he writes his own postscript to the review. It isn't a review of the book at all. Actually, he's just putting forth something that he would add to the whole thing. Now, of course, reviewers do this all the time, but I've never seen it done quite so definitely as in this particular play. Now then, point number two. Gardner emphasizes the contribution of the individual and of moral values as well as that of the social system itself to the process of renewal. I would place rather more emphasis on the role of the environment and the proper structuring of it to permit, encourage, and even force constructive change. I agree that the best social structure is a pluralistic system, but feel that this system needs further definition than Gardner gives it in this book. Now, a couple things here. I think he's absolutely right. The Gardner really hasn't given a definition to it because he can't. He doesn't have a base. He isn't functioning in a Christian consensus, and he's functioning in the post-Christian world. And as such, really, he's putting forth what I would call romanticism. But you will notice Kerr's suggestion, and that is that there must be a proper structuring to not only permit and encourage, but even force constructive change. Now, as soon as you say you're going to force constructive change, you have an entirely different situation. And I would give that to you because we'll come along and pick it up a little further along. Now I come to Lippmann. Lippmann, of course, is the man, the columnist, that most of those who are somewhat liberal in their viewpoint follow most carefully. And he's a man, surely, you can always read with profit. Man who has non-provincial views, and as such, one can read him with great interest. However, Lippmann I would class as a romanticist, but a romanticist who already in his own writings has struck the rock. I have here two Newsweeks, one of July 15 and one of July 22nd. Of 1963, interestingly enough. They're both in the same year, one week immediately after the other, and I'll read the later first, the latter issue. This comes from just his own column called Dealing with the Soviet Union. It says many interesting things, and then this is his great conclusion. A general idea, which is that the ideological quarrel between communism and anti-communism, a religious war, like Islam and Christendom, between Catholics and Protestants. History teaches us that religious wars are never won or lost. They are never wholly or finally settled. They cool down and fade away until they are no longer matters of life and death. Now, you'll notice here he brings in the fact of the ideological problem. And he says here that facing communism is an ideological thing, just like a religious war. And we'll pick up this word ideological a little bit further on in some of the articles. Immediately, one must say, well, in a way, looking at history, there's something in this. But, of course, there's another question, and that is, do all ideological wars only balance out? So what he's saying here is that you have a situation, you would have Roman Catholic Protestants, you have Islam and Christianity, the West and communism, and after all, it just simmers down. And I think the motion of my hands indicates really, as we shall see in a moment, properly the concept he has in mind. It is not just that you look at things, and indeed very often ideological struggles are worn out, but in Lippmann's mind there is something much more profound. It is that not only they sort of peter out as time goes on, but in reality this is what they should do. I think this is the distinction. This is the distinction. And in other words, in this concept, it isn't just looking at it as an observer, but it's something else. It's making a value judgment that in reality ideological things ought to be brought into synthesis, which is a very different mentality. You can say it's perfectly true, looking at most ideological wars, gradually they peter out or simmer down. Gradually something occurs and the situation changes. This is one thing. But as soon as you add the note that this was what they should do, then, of course, you have become the modern man. Then you're dealing with a dialectical methodology. Now, I think that this is not unfair to Lippmann, as illustrated in this review of his book in Newsweek, July 15, 1963, called The Essential Lippmann. It's probably the most important book Lippmann's put out. The Essential Lippmann, edited by Clinton Rostier and James Lahr, 552 pages, Random House, $7.50. The Essential Lippmann. And in it, here we find here Lippmann's basic philosophies brought together. Here's a good review. And let me point out, of course, that Newsweek, by 1963, was owned by the Washington Post and therefore is entirely agreeable to Walter Lippmann's philosophy. It's not not someone differing with him, but somebody who would want to say it in the strongest way possible in his praise. I'll read some of this because I think it has value. Contemporary criticism of Lippmann is more apt to come from men permeated or oppressed by the cynicism and skepticism of the times, who feel that he places altogether too much faith in the durability of the ideals of Western civilization, or that Lippmann refers to, or what Lippmann refers to as, quote, the Western traditions of civility. To this, his defenders may well be inclined to reply that mankind had better, in italics, had better reveal the potentials which Lippmann believes in. Otherwise, what is going to happen to anything that might conceivably be called civilization? Very interesting question from our viewpoint. They had better, but will they? They did it when they had a base. And you remember my using Toynbee last time in the first lecture of the series. But will they do it without a base? This is the intriguing thing. But it says here, Newsweek says, oh, they had better. They had better. What's going to happen to civilization? Well, I think Lippmann himself, by the end of this, shows what's going to happen to civilization, as I would see it. Lippmann, in short, has remained an idealist. He believes that man can learn and that man can choose. This is the reason I would put him among the romantic people at this time. Lippmann, in short, has remained an idealist. He believes that man can learn and that man can choose. And the people who would denigrate man's abilities, quote, have forgotten the immensely mysterious character of man. This reminds me very much of Reed's position. Just let the men go. And then, of course, I'd say this is idealistic. If you say, however, well, but what about what we have produced in Northern Europe and our Western culture, then, of course, one would say, yes, but what about the base? But, of course, I don't think Lippmann for a moment believes that the culture we have produced rests on the Reformation base. I think he has, because of his own position, missed the crucial point. So now you say, they had better, because what's going to happen to us if we don't? The idealist says, well, let's hope they will. Let's hope they will, and let's expect them to, because after all, didn't we produce something before? It seems to me the Christian answer is yes, but there's a different situation. The situation is that the Western culture, and expressly the Reformation culture after the Reformation in Northern Europe, which would include the United States and America, had a different situation than man has today. In other words, can we count on men hanging on to the cultural advantages after the base is gone? I would suggest that Lippmann's an idealist because in general here he says, well, I think they will. On down a little further, Great Aim is the subtitle. Lippmann believes in gradual human enlightenment. Lippmann believes in gradual human enlightenment. So here you have, of course, the thing which is common in our 20th century consensus, the concept of some sort of evolutionary thing. A little further on, the great aim, he believes, is government, not by waves of influence and opinion, but government under a widely extended body of law. He writes, the gradual encroachment of true law upon willfulness and caprice is the progress of liberty in human affairs. Down a little further, he believes that one world is not a theory but an inevitability. And down a little further, a longer section, at the end of this review, I'll read quite a little bit here because I think it's important. At the present time, he is vastly disheartened by the secular spirit of the age. That which puts the fine instrument of human reason at the service of personal desires. On this theme, he speaks with prophetic fervor. At bottom, he writes, the social problem is not that of satisfying men's objective needs. Modern technology is able to do that. The problem is that of man's subjective expectations, which, because they are unlimited and insatiable, cause violence, inequality, hatred, and frustration. There can never be contentment and peace of mind for modern man because their desires are irrational and therefore always expanding and forever unsatisfied. So he sees here a problem in his idealism. And of course the Christians say, but don't you understand that's sin? That's sin. This isn't related to just finiteness. It is perfectly true that no matter how much technological things give an advancement of goods and affluence, still, you find man insatiable. Insatiable whether it's for automobiles, yachts, second houses, or women. It doesn't matter. There's an insatiability. But why is there insatiability? Well, of course, the Christian would say it's because man is a sinner. But Lippmann doesn't have such an answer. Surely. Nothing in him that has this answer. So he just looks on at his idealism and then find it doesn't go. And he's vastly disheartened. To continue on, to pursue the good life is to cultivate not some but all the human dispositions by limiting each to a golden mean. Thus the demand for satisfaction, the promptings of appetite, the pressure of ambition, though recognized as natural and normal, are never unlimited. Men who live in this tradition are capable of brotherhood in a civilized society. They can prefer to do unto others what they would have others do unto them. Now, this is totally a romantic position, surely, in the light of human history. He goes on further. The essential Lippmann you notice what he's saying is here. If you practice the golden mean, which of course is Greek, if you practice the golden mean, men will become brothers. If you practice the golden mean, then you will get the golden rule. The essential Lippmann is a great plunge into all these enormous matters in which Lippmann can be found involving the golden mean and the golden rule of his political philosophy in any number of present connections. American world power, problems of American governmental structures, big industries and big unions, automation, the farm problem, education, culture, TV, public relations, ghostwriting, the questions of free speech, journalism, the representation of the U.S. abroad. The content of the book is ardent. The style is noted for its controlled lucidity and utter lack of bravo. In Walter Lippmann, we have a remarkable example of a learned and subtle mind maintaining faith in ancient but recently slighted teachings and applying them with passion and true eloquence to the involved dilemmas of this unhappy mid-century. In other words, why don't we go back? Why don't we go back to the time when these things were practiced? Well, of course, the Christian would say they had a base. They were practiced in a way they'd never been practiced in general. In man's history, because there was the base of the Reformation. Lippmann would simply build it on a rising scale. Lippmann believes in gradual human enlightenment, in which, in each case, you would simply take the golden mean, and then you come up with the golden rule. Now, in reality, of course, one must say a couple things here. In the first place, one must say, first of all, that many things, he's absolutely right, that many pragmatic things and many practical things, the golden rule, the golden means, does function. But there is a great jump between saying that in many things, the golden mean is the proper way of looking at things, a great jump from that, than using it as a basis of your philosophy to move from a golden mean to a golden rule. That's a very different thing. One can say in practice that in many, many places, a balance is a good thing. And in many, many places where you're not dealing with absolutes, there is a place for compromise. As a matter of fact, the Christian viewpoint would be that one should compromise where essentials are not involved. Often love means that there is a certain compromise. And with this sense, the Greeks had something with their golden mean. And not only that, but Lippmann would have something with his golden mean. But that's a different thing when your only basis of the golden rule, or the golden rule, is the golden mean. That isn't the same thing. So what you find now is a distinction that indeed in many areas of life, there is a place for compromise, there isn't a place for balance, there is a place for bringing things together. This is perfectly right. But is it a substantial base for building a brotherhood of man in which you would burst beyond the things which he views here as making him disheartened? And we would say no. I would say, first of all, let's notice what is involved. It's not, first, as I've said, it's not that in many, many places the golden mean is not a fine concept in many situations. But can you really come to your absolute on the basis of the golden mean? And then I would say no. Completely not. Seems to me here you have a very fine picture of dialectical thinking. The concept that you can take not some things in practice and practice them by compromise, but the way you get on to that which is your real standard, which will stand against your disheartenment of what you see in man, this insatiableness that we would call sin. The concept that you can build a sufficient base through the golden mean. Now we would say no, sure. So what you have here is a perfect example, in a way, very beautifully put, because Lippmann, of course, is a brilliant man, knows how to write, very beautifully put as to the dialectical mentality. Now at our Farrelhaus lecture the other day, Nicky asked a question that I thought showed real comprehension here, and what is the difference between the dialectical mentality and that which so often I say, and that is the Christian must fight on two fronts. Is there a difference or is it the same thing? And as I pointed out in that lecture, I think there's a strategic total difference. Strategic not only in the effects of matter strategy, but totally distinctive difference. Strategic in the sense that your view of this will color your thinking throughout life. The Christian view believes in antithesis because there is such a thing as truth. Lippmann, of course, functions out of a humanistic circle. And functioning out of a humanistic circle, there are no absolutes, really. Being no absolutes except what man himself would make, which, of course, are always arbitrary, eventually, because he is not infinite. This being so, all you can do is to try to build by bringing things together in this dialectical concept, because you don't really have a place for antithesis. Christian thinking, on the other hand, has a basis of antithesis, beginning with what is there. As we say so often here, it is not beginning with the Scripture even, though the Scripture tells us. But the antithesis turns upon something total, and that is what is there. And eventually God is there. Now this makes a great difference. He is there as opposed to not being there. He has a character. He has communicated. And I don't want to go into that. That'd be a separate lecture. And yet, that being so, there are fixed points of absolutes. Now then, in the Christian position, almost universally, if not universally, I would think universally, but say almost universally, the Christian position hardly ever has the luxury of having fighting on just one front. I can't think of a moment of history where Satan gave the Christians the luxury of one front to fight on. You always fight on two fronts. But when you fight on two fronts, it doesn't mean that the Christian position is achieved by a mixture of the two. It's quite different. You have an antithesis against both sides, and that's very different. It's very different. Superficially, it might look like a mixture, but it's never a mixture. And the illustration that seems to me the illustration of all illustrations dealing with the character of God himself, that you don't come to the Judistic Christian God by mixing the caricature some men have of a loving God who has no moral fiber and no moral character, and the caricature other men have of God being holy and therefore being harsh and only justice and having no love. You don't come to the Judistic Christian God by trying to put these two together and stir well, because each one is a complete false thing to what God is. Now you may say, well, does it really make a difference? Well, it makes a great deal of difference. It makes a great deal of difference because your methodology is involved. Littman says if you just take extremes and you bring them together, you always just get the golden mean, and there you go. But the golden mean, of course, is Hegel's concept. This is Hegelian. This is the heart of Hegelianism. Synthesis with the other two points of thesis and antithesis. Not so with the Christian position. Christian position says we function on antithesis, and we function on the antithesis to the high point of saying no to both of those things which are wrong on either side. And I feel that this is crucial in our way of thinking. Now, remember what I've said again. It is not to say that there aren't many practical aspects of life wherein, indeed, there is a place for balance. That is a very, very different thing. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about the area of absolute, and we're talking absolutes, and we're talking about methodology. One idea is the Greeks surely had it. This is Lippmann's idea. It's a humanistic ideal. I think it is a romanticism that you can just count on man with a little prodding to put the two together and get the best. Christian position is no. You begin. There are absolutes. The absolute existence of God. The communication of God from man. We can know something more than just what finite man would know. He can know it absolutely. And then you must have the courage to say no to the two equal evils. Now, of course, what we would say here, we would continually press that we must say no at the same time to a dead orthodoxy, and we must say this with just as great a fervor, no to dead orthodoxy, as to saying no to no orthodoxy. And you must have the courage of the double antithesis. Very different thing than thinking that you can build humanistically, rationalistically, a sufficient bridge to hold mankind against that which discourages Littman himself simply by the golden mean. I don't think there's any difference between what I've said now, using Littman's golden mean, and rejecting Hegelian thought. Now notice, however, that Littman himself, that Littman himself already feels this, and he puts forth a double proposition in suggestion. The great aim, he believes, is government not by waves of influence and opinion, but government under a widely extended body of law. The gradual encroachment of true law upon willfulness and caprice. And down further, he believes that one world is not a theory, but an inevitability. So now, here he is with his idealism, and yet he already sees, somehow or other, there has to be the force. And it's not that law is wrong, but can you get law on the basis of what he suggests? Can the law ever be what it should be if it only comes out of the humanistic circle of the golden mean? Well, a law is helpful in such a situation, but it would never be the law that produced the culture that Littman is looking back to with nostalgia. The interesting thing is, it seems to me, that you have exactly the same note here that you have in Kerr of the University of California. Notice what Kerr says. The proper structuring of it to permit and encourage and even force constructive change. Even force constructive change. Well, I don't think Littman's position is far from this. It is law. When you don't have an absolute, it is law which becomes in itself absolute in the sense of no challenge behind it. What are you going to base your law upon if you have no absolute in the universe? If there's no absolute, how do you build law that won't be finally oppressive? What are the checks and balances? To what can a person appeal? If there is nothing you can appeal to beyond the state, then is not the state really absolute? And history says yes, this is where men have gone. So it seems to me that Littman already would indicate that romanticism isn't going to go. We've had two things now. Gardner with his romanticism. Let's go back to the checks and balances, but without a base. And then Kerr must come along and say, well, how about a little force? Lippmann has to come along and say, well, what about this? It seems to me his concept of one world, and of course he's completely in his articles always committed to one world, world government, and a growing law. But a law always with no appeal beyond it. So now I would say the first suggestion of our world, the 20th century world, to the problem of relativism is a romantic one. But already you can see in the romantic answers that even the givers of the romantic answers sense that you have to have, and I'll just pick up Kerr's word for it. Now, the second suggestion, and then I'll pick it up later, the same thought as the third solution of our generation. The second solution of our generation would be that which would be, I think, ideally put forth by Aldous Huxley and Julian Huxley. I have here notes from the humanist frame. And the humanist frame is, I think, the best thing on humanism that's ever been printed. It's a book printed by Carson called The Humanist Frame, edited by Sir Julian Huxley, copyright in 1961. There are many humanists in this book, but the Julian Huxley is first, and Aldous Huxley is last in the book. Aldous Huxley on page 429 says this, and here he puts forth his idea of drugs. Now, the interesting thing is that this is the last suggestion in the book. Julian Huxley did the editing, and it's an intriguing thing that Aldous Huxley was given the last place. It's called Human Potentiality. That was the title of Aldous Huxley's article. Human Potentialities, and this is what he says on page 429. He then suggests that it might be possible by means of suitable pills and shots to establish new and favorable electrochemical balances in the healthy organism. Now, it's a very important thing. He's not talking about this as therapeutic. He's not talking about it as a cure for the mental breakdown. He isn't saying this. He's saying, what are we going to do to get on? What are we going to do with the healthy organism? So I'll read the sentence again. He then suggests that it might be possible by means of suitable pills and shots to establish new and favorable electrochemical balances in the healthy organism and in this way cause hitherto latent potentialities to be actualized. He continues by saying that in the case of depression drugs have been used, but in the, I'm sorry, that in the case of depression, drugs have been used to totally abolish a deep-rooted conviction of sin. And he suggests that in healthy individuals, drugs will probably be able to be used to bring these healthy individuals, quote, to a new position of equilibrium, at which organic functioning will be better. First-order experience is more enlightening, and symbol-manipulating, and this is tremendous, symbol-manipulating easier and more effective, end of quote. He quickly says that this could, of course, be used by Hitler or Stalin, but says that the likelihood of this will be lessened if nationalism is lessened, and suggests the way to achieve this is by caring for the armament race and the population there. Now, as in all these men, you have a tremendous idealism here. It's terrific, you see. It's perfectly true you can use it by Hitler, but it won't be again. Hitler and Stalin could have used it. That would be tremendous for Hitler and Stalin. But nevertheless, we're going to win the horse race. And I always, reading Dag Hammarskjöld, I was impressed with that. You get the feeling of these men, not because Dag Hammarskjöld had a wicked view at all, but simply because he had no real solid thing. You had a feeling with Dag Hammarskjöld that you had a horse race. And you had a black horse and a white horse. And he was just betting the white horse was going to win. That the world government, this is Dag Hammarskjöld's dream, of course, the world government was going to step in and stop the thing before the bomb fell. The white horse was going to win. Well, that's sort of the same idea you get here, that Stalin could use it, Hitler could use it, but the white horse is going to win this time, which is exceedingly idealistic and romantic, of course, idealistic in the bad sense. But now let's go back. Let's notice what he's suggesting. He's suggesting drugs. And as I say in so many of my lectures concerning using Aldous Huxley, when I mention him, it's totally naive to think that basically he's suggesting drugs as a means of escape. It has elements of escape, but that isn't the basic concept of the use of drugs. It's for a first-order experience, basically. But here you will notice in this book, which is one of the last things he wrote of importance, that you carry it on a bit. It's not just for a first-order experience, though he mentions the first-order experience, but it is using it on the healthy men in order to have first-order experiences. It would be more enlightening, but also that because it makes symbol manipulating easier and more effective. Of course, this is scary beyond all things. You will notice he also ties it into the fact that with those in the depression, you can totally abolish a deeply rooted conviction of sin by the use of drugs. I would just point out, surely, to Aldous Huxley, he would want to get rid of any concept of sin, and I would say, I think, any concept of absolute in the healthy individual. So what does he mean by symbol manipulating? Well, it's because our culture is finding that it needs somehow to be able, by the use of symbol manipulation, to control society. It is like this. It would be related to my lecture in what I think comes next, and lectures I gave at Wheaton and Boston and so places. The symbol manipulations. So now here you have Aldous Huxley putting forth a different solution than Romanticism, though it has romantic elements. It's tremendously idealistic, it's romantic, yet nevertheless there is a different element here. It's an element of manipulation. It's an element of manipulation by drugs. And this is a different idea. A manipulation by drugs. A manipulation to give society a structure in opposition to the results of relativism. This is the direction he'd be moving in. Now, Julian Huxley, of course, has a different idea, and one which I think is apt to be far more meaningful or powerful in the coming days, and I think it's the thing that you're going to have to fight against in your lifetime. In fact, I think we're fighting against it now, beyond merely the use of drugs, although the use of drugs, of course, is still very much to the fore. The whole LSD drug matter, all these things at Harvard, where you have a large number of people taking drugs, and that hasn't been over-exaggerated. I know from the boys who have become Christian at Harvard. Much drug taking in the desire for first-order experiences. So this is not going to be a small thing, but I think Julian Huxley has more potentiality, and that is religious manipulation. So on page 26, you remember Aldous Huxley's is 429, the end of the book, Julian Huxley on page 26, the beginning of the book. This is a direct quote. Finally, the evolutionary vision is enabling us to discern, however incompletely, the lineaments of the new religion that we can be sure will arise to serve the needs of the coming era. Just as stomachs are bodily organs concerned with digestion and involving the biochemical activity of special juices, so are religious psychosocial organs concerned with the problems of human destiny and involving the emotions of sacredness and the sense of right and wrong. Religion of some sort is probably necessary, period, capital B, but it is not necessarily a good thing, end of quote. It's a lovely, lovely paragraph. Because it was quite clear, and of course one wouldn't need to say this, you all know it, Aldous Huxley is an atheist, completely committed to atheism. He had the same viewpoint as humanists had in general up to a few years ago, the same idea that his grandfather had, and that is a religion was not only bunk, but was something to be squashed. But about 8 or 10 years ago now, something like that, a little more, a little less, plus or minus, he stood up in Chicago at a great Congress for evolution and startled everybody by advocating a use of religion. It was the first complete about face. He made very plain what he meant, not that he thought there was any chance there was a God or was a God, but rather that that by observation, man functions better if he acts as if a God is there. And consequently, society will put forth an evolutionary concept of society. And as a matter of fact, that Chicago speech, as I remember, he bordered it with two careful things. that religion itself would be seen to be evolutionary, and point two, that it would be under the control of society. So now you have society or the state. One would think immediately of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. The society or the state, and society and the state must be kept separate as two different concepts, and yet they keep blending and re-blending. Society or the state would deliberately make a religion to manipulate the culture, to give structure. And I feel this is something that is very much upon us in our generation. Now then, this is a notice what we're doing. Here you have relativism, and it leads to Berkeley, and it leads to so-and-so. All the things that we have dealt with in the first lecture, first 2 hours. Relativism leads to so-and-so. What can be done about it? Now you can take a romantic stance, but already in the romantic people themselves, you feel a motion toward force, seems to me. Because even with a romanticism, it doesn't go. Especially somebody's dealing on as wide a stage as Littman. Then, however, you come to Aldous Huxley and Julian Huxley, the humanists, and they put forth manipulation. And especially, it seems to me, the most brilliant suggestion that's been made yet in this area is religious motivation by Julian Huxley. As I told some of you, here in Switzerland, a certain number of years ago, I don't know what it was now, 4 or 5 years ago, they had a meeting of many of the psychologists and sociologists and so forth in some little Swiss village, but brilliant men, and asked, what can we do for our young people? Our young people no longer have any interest in anything very much. I thought it was very humorous and Swiss. They said, not even in politics. In Switzerland, I thought this was intriguing. But what do we do? And they said, we need a new mystique. And what will we do to make the mystique? We need a religious mystique. And it seems to me this is exactly the same thing here. Now, of course, immediately at this place, though this isn't the place to develop it in total detail, it seems to me we have a new mystique, and it is the new theology. So I would believe that at this particular place, suddenly theology has a chance to cease being the tail that was on the dog and to become again the queen of sciences. But in a way that is very frightening to me. As I keep pointing out, for a long, long time, theology, I don't mean biblical theology, but liberal theology, from the old liberal to the neo-orthodox to the new theology, the Marburgers and all the rest, the God of dead people, or whichever way you want to turn, that this has always come last. Theology has never been new for a long, long time. Everything that happens in theology, if you know the other disciplines, has already occurred before. So, as I so often say, people who come to me and are excited about something new in the new theology, I think they're almost always naive. That if they had known only the structure of the other cult, the other disciplines, they would have been able to see it. They would have been able to see it in the previous discipline. But now suddenly we have a chance that theology, and I don't mean this is a good thing, but it's terrifying to me in the suggestion of Julian Huxley. It is terrifying to me. It is that suddenly we have a situation where I think think the new theology can become queen. Instead of being the tail on the dog, I think it can become the structure of the whole in the sense of it being there full-blown from the sea, of a new mystique, a mystique that is open to total manipulation both in the Protestant side and the new Roman Catholic progressives. Total manipulation because it is without content. There is no content. It is purely open to the authority. I remember there is one famous little thing that Bishop Robison said in one of his things, and he said, of course, love is enough, but if you don't know what love means in a situation, I'm not quoting him word for word, but it's the direction. If you don't know what love means in a situation, don't worry, the church will tell you. And then this is really frightening. Because, of course, love can mean kill everybody. I mean, that's a perfectly possible definition of love in a situation like this. So it seems to me, here now we have the Protestant new theology, and we have the Roman Catholic progressives, and and here they stand very much together. We can think of Allen's review of this book on the Christ of Hinduism, the hidden Christ of Hinduism. Anything is possible to this, it seems to me. I cannot conceive, personally, of anything that gives some time couldn't be brought into the circle of the new theology. I just can't conceive of anything so monstrous that it couldn't be included in this kind of situation. And we're already seeing it in places. The whole concept of Christian morality becoming that which, say, in England, in many circles, Christian morality becoming that which is totally opposite to Christian morality. How far can you get? Well, I think you can go to any distance if you take a non-contentful thing, using religious terms that are rooted deep into the race and therefore getting motivations, strong motivations beyond drugs, it seems to me, but under your definitions and without any control. Now, of course, in the scripture, you have something different, a scriptural situation. So when Paul preached, the Bereans opened the Bible to see if these things were so. Here you had a control in the Westminster Confession of Faith, in the Reformation in general. You have a situation where the church can only give declarative statements in which they can show that they are rooted clearly in an exegesis of scripture. I don't mean they always did it in practice, but it was the theory. You have a control. But here, in the new situation, there is no control. It seems to me that Julian Huxley's suggestion and the new theology fit perfectly. Now, immediately, though, you have a difficulty. And the difficulty is, of course, you have a difficulty and the thing which will then, I think, lead to the necessity of force. In that, the new theology, as it is rooted in the dialectic, as it is rooted really in a concept that's very, very close, if it is not actually pantheism, the difficulty is that you have nothing really to point to that you can say it is this way intrinsically. You must make whatever there's going to be. And you remember my lecture in Farrell House using John Hick. This came from the Listener of August 12, 1965. And you remember some time ago at a Farrell House lecture, I dealt with this book of John Hick as John Hick spoke over the BBC broadcast, as was reported in the Listener of August 12, 1965, so it's very recent. His book is called The Problem of Evil, Evil and the God of Love, which has now been published. And John Hick has wrestled with this problem, and of course he's an important man, and he is on both sides of the Atlantic, and he has wrestled with this problem very strongly. And his concluding statement on this, his talk on the third program, runs like this. Now, just say in parenthesis, he claimed that all the way back to Irenaeus, that this kind of thing he was putting forward has been suggested by a large section of the church. I don't think this would stand up to a careful view of Irenaeus' position. However, that's unimportant. It's very parallel to Heidegger appealing to the pre-Socratic Greeks before Aristotle. It's interesting, but it doesn't enter into the discussion. Whether they did or not is not too important. The ideas are important. Even if you showed that it wasn't so, that Irenaeus held, it wouldn't change his Hick's view. The only reason it would be good for Hick at this particular place is that he would be putting forth something that he would say had an honorable place, though a minor place, in the church in the past, in contrast to the Augustinian concept. The alternate, this is his last paragraph, the alternate Irenaean type of theodicy has been more ready to say explicitly that God, as the sole creator and ruler of the universe, bears the ultimate responsibility for it, that is, for evil in the universe. For there is no one else to share that final responsibility, and it is indeed perhaps as presumptuous as it is ineffectual for theologians to attempt to relieve God of it by taking it upon mankind. That was the end of his lecture. Remember, some time ago at a Farrell House lecture, I dealt with this book of John Hick as John Hick spoke, over the BBC broadcast, as was reported in the Listener of August 12, 1965, so it's very recent. His book is called The Problem of Evil, Evil and the God of Love, which has now been published. And John Hick has wrestled with this problem, and of course he's an important man, and he is on both sides of the Atlantic, and he has wrestled with this problem very strongly. And his concluding statement on this, his talk on the third program, runs like this. Now, if just say in parenthesis, he claimed that all the way back to Irenaeus, that this kind of thing he was putting forward has been suggested by a large section of the church. I don't think this would stand up to a careful view of Irenaeus's position. However, that's unimportant. It's very parallel to Heidegger appealing to the pre-Socratic Greeks before Aristotle. It's interesting, but it doesn't enter into the discussion. Whether they did or not is not too important. The ideas are important. Even if you showed that it wasn't so, that Irenaeus held, it wouldn't change his Hick's view. The only reason it would be good for Hick at this particular place is that he would be putting forth something that he would say had an honorable place, though a minor place, in the church in the past, in contrast to the Augustinian concept. The alternate, this is his last paragraph, the alternate Irenaean type of theodicy has been more ready to say explicitly that God, as the sole creator and ruler of the universe, bears the ultimate responsibility for it, that is, for evil in the universe. For there is no one else to share that final responsibility, and it is indeed perhaps as presumptuous as it is ineffectual for theologians to attempt to relieve God of it by taking it upon mankind. That was the end of his lecture. Here, of course, he has thrown away indeed the historic stream of the church, just as he says with the Augustinian concept. But also this undoubtedly is rooted in the whole thing we wrestle with here, and that is the dialectical mentality as opposed to synthesis. It's rooted back into the area undoubtedly of a direction toward pantheism, because in pantheism the opposites are always equally present. So, as I would point out many times, in the Hindu concept, the male and the female are equally in God, but equally in the sense that therefore they cancel out eventually to the neuter, and cruelty and non-cruelty are in God in the sense that eventually they cancel out to the neuter. I'm sure such a man as John Hick would try to drag his feet and not be dragged this far. But it seems to me, nevertheless, it's exactly in this direction. And it doesn't stand alone. It's a part of a tendency of the whole new theology in this direction. But you will notice, of course, that there are two terrifying results to this. The first terrifying result would be that therefore man has no real meaning because he doesn't achieve anything. You can't beat it. You have a mathematical dilemma that you never get above. And that is, as soon as you have this concept of infinity or God, then the particulars no longer have any meaning. I mean, it's just a mathematical dilemma. The East, I think, has defined the problem far better than the West. Namely, if there is anything that's infinite in the sense of containing all, then, after all, the particulars are totally meaningless. Now, the Christian God, of course, is a very different concept. He doesn't contain all. And as I've said so many, many times, everybody has a limited God. It just depends what kind of a limitation you choose. The pantheistic God is not limited in that he contains everything, but he is limited in that he cannot then be personal. The Christian God, the Judaistic Christian God, is personal, but he is limited in the sense that evil is excluded from him. And you take one or the other and finally arrive at a decision. And the difficulty is, if everything is finally equal in God, then the particulars come to no meaning. You cannot find any reason to say the cruel is of a different final order than the non-cruel in such a situation. And the man who chooses for the non-cruel as against the cruel, when you come to the last play on the board, has made no better choice. Not really. And, of course, then you have a second thing. So the first thing that disappears is the meaning of moral choices. And eventually the man disappears in importance because the choice no longer leads to that which has an absolute difference, makes a final absolute difference. The second thing which is terrifying is the fact that then, of course, you have no real moral absolute in the universe. So in the area of the meaningfulness of man, making choices, and in the area of morals, eventually you come to a sea without a shore. You come to a sea without a ripple. This means, therefore, that there are no intrinsic things you can appeal to. You can't say this is intrinsically right, this is intrinsically wrong. You can say love is intrinsically right, but you must define love. And a good point could be made for love, meaning pushing the button that would blow up the world in such a situation. Another thing which I spoke of in that same lecture when I was dealing with Opie, and we'll bring it with it at this particular time, is this thing of Teddy, a story that's worth knowing that Salinger wrote, J.D. Salinger. And this is nine stories, just a little book put out by Signet. But the last one is called Teddy, and I think it's one of the most striking things I know of Salinger's. And it runs like this. It's on a boat. A man comes and he talks to this brain. And the brain is about 13 years old, as I remember. I should have glanced through the story to be sure. I think he's 13, as I remember. But he has put all the pundits of the world to shame. He runs them all into the ground. And on the boat, he meets with this fellow who's also who's a university student, bright, brilliant young fellow. And so they have a conversation sitting in the deck chair. And Teddy puts forth his proposition. And his proposition really is pure humanism. I mean, pure Hinduism. Pure Hinduism, both in the concepts of the transmigration of souls, but also in the concept of just what I've put forward, it seems to me, where John Hick is. And that is, after all, there is no difference. There's no real difference whatsoever. And so as he's talking, Teddy puts forth the proposition. He has a sister, and he says, after all, people are afraid to death. When he was meeting with this great crowd of a brilliant man, he pointed out to them, the people are afraid to death, but it's only conditioned, because after all, there is no real difference in a pantheistic system. And the little girl finally comes to get him, and he's been making a big point of the fact that it really makes no difference. It really makes no difference at all in theory. And then his little sister comes and get him and says, come on, it's time to go to the swimming pool. So he leaves, and after he leaves and heads on toward the swimming pool, that is the boy Teddy, this university student follows him. And this is the end of the story. At D-Deck, the four-ship stairway ended, and Nicholson stood for a moment, apparently at some loss for direction. However, he spotted someone who looked able to guide him. Halfway down the passageway, a stewardess was sitting on a chair beside a galleyway, or outside a galleyway, reading a magazine and smoking a cigarette. Nicholson went down to her, consulted her briefly, thanked her, then took a few additional steps forward and opened a heavy metal door that led to the pool. It opened into a narrow, uncarpeted staircase. He was little more than halfway down the staircase when he heard an all-piercing, sustained scream, clearly coming from a small female child. It was highly acoustical, as though it were reverberating within four tiled walls. So the boy had just pushed his sister down into the empty swimming pool. And Salinger isn't just writing a story. He's made a strong point. Why not? Why not? So with a new mysticism, couched in the new terms of God without a character, of things equally coming from God, and he cannot beat this. He surely cannot beat this. You have a neutral situation, a neutral situation. Yet in spite of this, with the dialectical theology, the new theology, beginning with Karl Barth and flowing onward, ever increasing in its clarity of what it is saying, Tillich and so on, carrying on beyond this, the God is dead theology, but into other sections, you do have the fact that nevertheless, it has a strong hold. It has if man needs a mysticism, it has a built-in advantage. And the built-in advantage, it seems to me, of the new theology as in opposition, for example, to Adolf Steiner, that two of us were talking about the other day, is twofold. First of all, it is in the organizational framework of the church. So it has the machinery. It has the machinery. It has, even though it's been a dead prestige for a long time, it has the prestige. The second thing is that it's using terms that are well understood and that are deep in the consciousness of the race. Now, as I make the point so often, Carl Gustav Jung spoke of the collective unconscious. We can reject his basic concept of the collective unconscious and yet be well aware that he was saying something that is very, very valuable. And that is why I don't believe that you have a collective unconsciousness here. You do have something that can be called the mentality of the people, of the race. Something that's rooted not down where he would root it into the evolutionary concept of in every man there is the frog snapping at the fly. It isn't this, surely. But nevertheless, that there are certain terms in our cultures which are like an electric light button. You push them and something occurs. Now then, I think this is related to the difference between definition of words and connotation of words. And a man can reject a definition of the word, and yet the connotation be very useful in getting him to move. And I think we see this all the time. It is very, very easy to get rid of definitions, in a sense. For a man, by definition, to get rid of the word God. But that's a very different thing from getting rid of the spring that is touched in himself, in his family situation, but in the culture, in the art that surrounds us, in everything of the word, let's say, the cross. The cross. In working with seeing conversions among Roman Catholics and Christian Scientists, any religion that has a kind of authoritative base, I've helped many of these people wrestle through their problems, some very intelligent people. And they say, how is it? I don't believe it anymore. And yet, nevertheless, there's something there. And we've come to the conclusion, working together, that what you can get rid of is the definitions, but not the connotation. That the connotation sometimes hangs on to you much longer than the definition. Now then, in our culture, we have connotations. It isn't just individual thing. We have a culture. If you mention the name Vishnu here, it doesn't release very much. If you mention the name Christ, however, and the open tomb and the cross, it is like pushing a button, and you don't have to think. It's just like hitting a typewriter key, in a sense. You get certain thrust, and I think this is the new theology's advantage, and it's terrifying this to me. Is that it's perfectly possible to push the buttons in our culture with exactly what Julian Huxley is asking for, a manipulated situation, yet nevertheless with motivations that will establish social framework. People don't have to, people have much more possibility of them responding to this than it is to, say, Aldous Steiner's Eastern thinking. Or theosophy, or something like this. You take Wagner's Parsifal, you can feel it. Wagner's Parsifal is not Christian, it's Hindu. It really is Eastern in its structure. And yet, because the cross is used and the Holy Grail, you get results. It's very curious. And it's because most people don't analyze, I guess, partially. There's a confusion in their mind between the connotation and the definition. And somehow or other, by the grace of God, we who are Christians in this century must learn for ourselves and our children to fight this, if I understand correctly. The second thing of our 20th century, meeting the relativism, which they might not care about, say, in certain areas, say, personal sexual morals, and yet care about in the breakdown that's coming in our culture. The first answer is romanticism, but already, as I say, you find it doesn't hold. Then you come, it seems to me, to the Aldous Huxley drug situation, the Julian Huxley religious motivation situation, and you immediately then are brought into the fact, however, there's nothing really absolute here. Hicks' problem, Salinger's Teddy. So what do you get? Well, then you get a manipulated situation. And it's my own term, as you know, but I think it's a good term. And that is what you get is a religiously motivated set of arbitrary absolutes. Arbitrary absolutes that are open to total manipulation under the control of society. But much more profound than any other arbitrary absolute, I think, simply because you touch the wellspring of the race somehow in this, at a very deep point. I think in this, it is I've brought together the Roman Catholic progressive and the new theology, the Protestant liberal. And I think it is interesting that both of them, both the Roman Catholic progressive, the new statements of the Pope recently, I don't mean recently in 2 years, but recently, and the Protestant, the liberal Protestant churchmen, it's interesting that they're in exactly the same direction as Walter Lippmann, and that is one world, increased government, increased force. And this is their direction. And I don't think this is by chance. I think it is a matter of mentality here that fits exactly into this thought. Now, the third solution, as I see it, of our world in the 20th century in the light of the relativism and its breakdown in Watts, in Berkeley, etc., 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 in not just one country, but all of our countries. The third, I've already touched on a sense when I've spoken of Kerr and I've spoken of Lippmann, but now I'll make it a specific point, and that is government. The third solution that as I see it, is government. Now, you felt all this already in the where Gardner speaks of checks and balances, but the trouble is he has no base for checks and balances. Where did the sense of checks and balances which produced the democracy? Democracy never has existed in the way it has since the Reformation. Never existed out in other situations. I don't mean that you can't find small pockets of it, you can, but in general. Sometimes people appeal to the Greeks, Plato's Republic. But of course, this isn't democracy. Not really, not if you understand Plato's Republic. It's built on a strata of slaves. You have the philosopher kings. It's a very opposite idea, in a sense, of democracy. When you get down to the end. I feel that democracy, which has functioned into the sinfulness of men. Now, Lippmann has defined, he doesn't call it sin, but the dilemma, the insatiable appetite. What has given us the possibility of having democracy against the sin? And I feel that it's the Reformation, the little statement that's so profound that you didn't need a king simply because every man had a king in his heart. The priesthood of all believers, all these things are wrapped together. And I have a quote here from John Calvin that I think is very interesting. This is a direct quote from Calvin. The vice or imperfection of men, therefore, renders it safer and more tolerable for the government to be in the hands of many, that they may afford each other mutual assistance and admonition, and that if one arrogate to himself more than is right, the many may act as censors and masters to restrain his ambition. That's a tremendous thing. If any of you want to copy it afterwards, you're welcome to. The vice or imperfection of man, in other words, it's sin. Calvin understands that it isn't just a strange malady man has, the way Lippmann would see it, something on the evolutionary plane. But it's sin. Calvin would understand what it is. But now here you look at the human race and there it is. The vice or imperfection of man therefore renders it safer and more tolerable for the government to be in the hands of many, that they may afford each other mutual assistance and admonition, and that if one arrogate to himself more than is right, the many may act as censors and masters, notice masters, to restrain his ambition. To restrain his ambition. And here you have the Reformation solution to government. It was a solution of checks and balances. The selection of the choicest checks and balances. Every Reformation country that was the basis of the government was a government of checks and balances. Now, in no two countries did it take exactly the same form. So the Swiss checks and balances are quite different from the Dutch, let's say. And the Dutch checks and balances are quite different from the English. And the English is even somewhat different from the American. But nevertheless, regardless of the detail, the heart of the thing was a series of checks and balances. So therefore, I always like to point out the Swiss. I like the Swiss sensibleness at this place. They even put the Supreme Court in a different setting, in a different canton. Is the rest of the government in Bern? Then by everything that's sensible in Switzerland, we will put the Supreme Court in Lausanne. So you got Lausanne against Bern, and immediately you'll have checks and balances, to put it mildly here. You know, a freedom from pressures. A freedom from pressures. This wasn't just I'm sure this wasn't just a fluke. They really understood this. They've done it in each of our governments. In the United States of America, we have many, many different sets of kinds of checks and balances. You have the states, and they were very careful not to give their right to the central government. They really wouldn't. Such a thing, and they show what they meant. They wouldn't give up their guns. They wouldn't allow the central government to register their guns, to call in their guns, because the states wanted to be absolutely sure, come a showdown, that the states really would be states. They could really do something. This is their idea. You have the Electoral College. The Electoral College, an amazing mentality of checks and balances. Really. Then within the central government itself, you had three departments. You had the administrative, and you had the judicial, and you had the parliament, the Congress. and these were placed so that they really were, in a way, locked. Just exactly what Calvin would have suggested. I think Calvin would have said, hooray. This really shows the Reformation mentality. This really shows the Reformation culture here at this particular place. So you have all kinds of checks and balances. It leads to a certain inefficiency. But I remember when I went to school, I had an old teacher that used to stand up, dear old lady, and she used to say, democracy is inefficient, but it's a price you pay for democracy. And this dear old soul really understood something. She really had some comprehension. Democracy is not the best form of government. Just say this. It is the best form of government in a fallen world. And that's a very different thing. The best form of government, undoubtedly, is one man. And the best form of government will come when Christ reigns on the earth. This is the best form of government. There'll be no democracy in the millennium. I don't mean it won't be democratic in certain ways, because the early church was obviously democratic, and so there'll be. I'm not saying there won't be democratic elements. But nevertheless, when Christ is king, you don't need checks and balances. In opposition to this, the worst form of government undoubtedly will be under the Antichrist, which also will be slickly efficient. Who can make war with a beast? So the best form of government, as far as slickness is concerned, undoubtedly is not democracy. But Calvin and the Reformation was not dealing with ideal situation as to just efficiency in government. They were dealing with the reality of a fallen world. And you remember how Calvin begins this little thing. The vice, what does he say? The vice and imperfection of men renders it. This is what is this way. So these men really were realists. This is what I keep saying. Christianity is a religion of realism as opposed to all romanticisms. All romanticisms. There are all kinds of romanticisms. And Professor Vanderlip was here and gave his lecture. He pointed out, it's better to say romanticisms maybe than romanticism, because there are many kinds of romanticisms. But the idea of romanticisms is romanticism. So here you go. And there are many kinds of romanticisms, and Christianity is not romantic, it is bitterly realistic. And many, many times I've seen it actual function, where I would sit down with a realist who was a cynic, a nihilist, and we would be facing a romantic man, even if he used a Christian terminology. And for the first part of the conversation, time after time, the cynic and myself would be on the same side until the romanticist was gone. Because the world isn't beautiful. You can just... has many beautiful things in it. But you can idealize, you can set all the utopias you want, but it doesn't go. You remember again Professor Vanderlip's lecture on the king, on the city of God and the city of man. Very fine lecture, actually. He gave us just before he left. Now in this situation, therefore, Christianity is not romantic. It is realistic. And the other realist may not understand why we have the situation, but he says, well, here it is. And the Christian says, yes, here it is, and then here's the reason for it. That's the difference. So Christianity is realistic, and it's realistic not only in theory, it is realistic in that very, very important place of church government and the government of the state. We live in a situation in which force is needed at times, but it is force that in which you don't trust yourself. So in the state that was produced out of the Reformation, you had a deliberate choice of checks and balances, not for efficiency of government as far as utopian concept of efficiency is concerned, but efficiency of government in a fallen world. Now you have immediately, of course, the modern man doesn't have the base for this. So what are you going to do? Well, you have, remember, Lippmann. What are you going to do? You're going to make a golden mean. What are you going to do? Well, you're not going to... You either go down the drain in cynicism or you take a different direction. And as I've said, Newsweek, of course, for some time, a long time ago now, was bought by the Washington Post. The Washington Post is a liberal paper. It's a humanist in its attitudes. And after the Newsweek was purchased, one of the commentators that came into the paper then that wasn't there before into Newsweek is Kenneth Crawford. And I have here an article called Why Are the Founders Confounded by Kenneth Crawford in Newsweek of April 19, 1965. I've deliberately chosen things in most cases which are very recent. And this is what he says. It's intriguing. I'll read you parts, but the part, what I'm reading, is fair to the whole. The daughters, of course you know who that would be, the daughters of the American Revolution, the daughters hold that the Constitution was intended to create a system so finely checked and balanced that none of its components, executive, legislative, or judicial, would have power of quick decision. So he says what the daughter says. But later you see that he admits, too, that really was the case, all right. A little bit further down, the evil the Constitution makers knew and guarded against was the tyranny of monarchs. Yes and no. I would say what they were guarding against was tyranny, and the tyranny which was the thing immediately that they had was the tyranny of monarchs. But they really weren't just against monarchs, they were against tyranny. That's what Calvin says. It would be tyranny whether no matter how it was imposed. Not just the monarch, but wherever tyranny is. The feeling in the Christian building of America, not saying that the individual men were Christian at all, born-again Christians, but a Christian consensus, that we have to guard against tyranny, that you don't trust anybody. You don't even trust yourself, because you too are a sinner. So if you're going to be head of government, you'd like to have some checks and controls also. So in a way, this is right and it's wrong. The tyranny of monarchs was the thing they had immediately in front of them, but it wasn't the monarch they were against, it was the tyranny they were against. And they saw, and they had, and incidentally, it's very remarkable that the Reformation built democracies that really have worked and have become the ideal of the world in a very real way. Then he goes on a little further. The tools it uses must be fashioned from a document now almost 2 centuries old. The remarkable thing about it is that these tools can be made to do the job. Until Roosevelt's New Deal, there was no certainty that the imperatives of government in a modern society could be served by the Constitution. But ways were found by stretching here and here and padding there. I like that picture. To reconcile contemporary need with a basic law, if the need was clear enough for public recognition. Now, let me quickly say, one must make a very careful distinction. And that is, often the individual things that have come forward in the padding and the pulling have been good in themselves. That isn't the point. We have no interest here of debate over this good and that good, which undoubtedly has come forth in the midst of the whole, let's say, in the worker government in England, in the socialists in Holland. This isn't what we're discussing. It just isn't what we're discussing. Undoubtedly, there's been many things of detail which the Christian would be glad about. But that isn't the point. The point is, how do you keep pushing it on? What's your method of achieving? What are you doing? What are you doing to the whole? And this man, Kenneth Crawford, shows a very real understanding in this area. In Roosevelt's time, the President and Congress agreed on certain innovations, only to be checked by the Supreme Court. This was the founder's balance operating against change. So now he agrees that this was the founder's. It isn't just he throws a stone at the daughters of the American Revolution. You've got to do that, of course. And play a thing like Newsweek, it's important to throw a stone. But he's saying here, it is true that the founders did have this idea against change. Now, I don't think that's true either, quite though, because they weren't against change. They were just against a change that was without checks and balances and controls. Then he goes on. Last week, the founders were confounded to an unprecedented decree. A little further on, all this had become possible because for once, courts, Congress, and the executive were all of equally progressive mind. They were proceeding in the same direction at about the same speed. Moreover, they moved unprodded either by world war or domestic depression. Such a confluence of forces had never occurred before and might never occur again. Now, he shows later he doesn't really think it'll not occur again. I would say, right you are, I rather agree that what he's pointing to, that particular point, did show they came together. But I just think they're going to stay together. I don't mean there won't be some pushing and pulling, but they'll stay together. So, because the mentality has changed. And now notice what he says a little right here. Senator Joseph Clark of Pennsylvania proposes that members of Congress, senators as well as representatives, be elected along with the president for 4-year terms instead of 6 and 2-year terms as they are now. Now, why? Under this system, the president's party would almost always command a majority in Congress as it does now. So, in other words, it's all finished. The game's over.
All the checks and balances are out the window. The conclusion is like this. This is how it has been. Ergo, this is how it should always be. But things will never be that way again. And I think he's absolutely right. I just think he's right. I feel that it'll never be really again because people aren't going to accept the results of relativism now that our base is gone. There's something, men won't accept the chaos. They will accept the answer of government instead. But if things will never be that way again. Hard as it is normally to move forward under the Father's commandments, it is even harder to back up. I think he really understands something. It's gone, and you're not going to reverse it. The only way to reverse it would be if people once more grew a Reformation consensus. There's no sign of that, and consequently, the chance of backing it up merely by, let's say, a right-wing mentality or a conservative mentality, this is like trying to bail out the sea. It just doesn't go. So here you have a statement. The checks and balances are gone, and they are gone. You remember what I pointed out to you about Heller and Fulbright, the use of the puritanical ethic, Playboy magazine, puritanical ethic. It's really gone. It's really gone. But always remember what I'm saying. This is not for a moment forgetting that lots of the detail that has been accomplished in the pushing and the pulling and the padding have been good details. That's the terror of it, in a sense. And as Crawford says, all right, you give it up for a good thing. He doesn't say it this way. But nevertheless, it's what really the indication is. You give it up for a good thing, but just you try to get it back. Just you try to get it back. It doesn't go. It doesn't go. The breakdown in the checks and balances, I would say, coming faster and faster. There's no use trying to say, let's just stop it as a thing in itself, because you must understand there's a tremendous pressure. It is the pressure of the relativism which we dealt with in the first lecture, in the 2 hours. A relativism that isn't just in sexual morality, a relativism that surrounds us, a relativism that builds up a tremendous head of steam. Because what are you going to do with it? Are you really going to let it smash everything to pieces? Are you really going to let your culture go down the drain? Are you really going to allow the whole thing to become chaotic? What are you going to do? What are you really going to do? What are you going to do faced with England's with its group, for example? What are you going to say? What are you going to say? And people choose. They don't have a reason for choosing to in the other direction. They don't have a base for choosing it. There's not a base to do something better in a post-Christian world, and so they choose. And the tragedy is often they choose at the point of a good. And they choose the good, and the structure is further destroyed. You have many, many areas of this. You have the states' rights, of course. The sad thing is that the battle of state rights in America has been fought at most of the wrong places. Almost always, nobody fought for state rights until there was something that was so clearly for personal gain that the principle was already discredited. You have the same thing with management and workers. We have seen in the present time, in the last few years, management and workers no longer having freedom. This is in the direction of exactly what Crawford's saying here. Management and workers can't manage their own affairs anymore. The government is big. Does the federal government help the schools? Well, then they'll bring pressure. Maybe they bring pressure today at a good point, but the pressure's there. Just nobody's free after this. The biggest thing, perhaps, is the area of law. And you remember there is a Farrell House lecture or a series of them on relativism in law. This came largely with a Supreme Court shift in the United States, but it's not just America, it is also in England. I was very fortunate to get hold of the American Bar Association Journal of August 1956, which was the American Bar Association's dealing with the change in the Supreme Court's type of government. And it isn't just America, because, for example, in 1965, just this year I read in the Listener a BBC broadcast in which it was saying, by a man who was in favor of it, that the idea in England of law has changed, that he was pointing out that it has always been so that the courts have made law,
that this can't be helped, in a sense. But he said, in the last few years in England, this has just speeded up to, it's an entirely new situation. It isn't just a difference of degree, it's a different situation. The courts are making law. And, of course, this is the end of the checks and balances. Now, it's exactly the same thing with the American Supreme Court, new mentality, beginning with Oliver Wendell Holmes through the Yale Law School, coming down into the general concepts of law. In this thing, the first letter, Views of Our Readers, which is the first thing that appears in this American Bar Association Journal of August 1956, there is a letter by William I. Potter, pardon me, of Kansas City, Missouri. The article in your June issue by R. Carter Pittman of the Georgia Bar on the Fifth Amendment, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, is a valuable contribution to the historical background of the Bill of Rights. It is also a glaring disclosure of judicial rape of the self-incriminating clause of the Fifth Amendment, which is nothing short a usurpation by the judiciary of the power to amend the Constitution by judicial decree instead of by amendment as provided by the Constitution. Mr. Pittman, by preparing and you, by publishing this article, have reminded the American Bar of another of the repeated instances of the means by which the United States Supreme Court is gradually eroding our basic liberties, state rights, while fashioning an all-powerful federal government. Let us hope more lawyers who, of all our citizens, are best able to understand and appraise the threatened danger will vigorously offer their opposition to this trend before it is too late. As I say, this isn't just American, but this thing in England has taken on a whole new face. The making of law by the courts without those checks and balances that Parliament was supposed to have. Parliament's supposed to make the law, the courts are supposed to process them. Here you have the whole thing flattened.